They told you black history began with chains. But what if I told you we once built a global nation without a single drop of permission? The UNI wasn't just a movement. It had its own flag, its own government, its own army, nurses, shipping line, and newspaper. From the streets of Harlem to the shores of Ghana, it united over 6 million people across continents before the empire struck back. They arrested the leader, burned the papers, sank the ships, but what they couldn't kill was the blueprint. Today, that legacy still moves through us, in every chant, every flag, every act of black self-determination. This isn't a forgotten story. It's a stolen one, and it's time we took it back. If you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. What was the UNI? The birth of a black power engine. A nation without land, but not without purpose. There has never been another organization like it. Not before, not since. The Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, known simply as the UNIA, was not just a movement. It was not just a protest. It was a blueprint, a black nation-building machine designed to exist outside the reach of white empire. It was founded not out of reaction, but vision. The vision was simple. The redemption of Africa, the dignity of black people, and the building of a sovereign future, free from white rule. Where most organizations of the early 20th century begged for equality inside systems that were never made for them, the UNIA said, "We will build our own." Where others asked to be included, the UNIA demanded independence. It was not moderate. It was not patient. It was revolutionary and unapologetically black. Foundational premise, what the UNIA believed. At its core, the UNIA believed three radical things. Radical only because the world rejected them. That black people were a global nation, not scattered, but dispersed. A people forcibly separated by slavery, colonization, and geography, but still connected by heritage, pain, and possibility. That this global nation had the right to self-rule, economically, politically, spiritually, and culturally. They didn't want integration into white systems. They wanted liberation from them. That Africa was the motherland, the rightful throne, and the symbolic and literal home of the black race. A place to be reclaimed, not abandoned. The UNIA called this vision African redemption. And everything, every flag, every office, every speech, every ship, was built toward that goal. It wasn't just an organization, it was a government in waiting. The UNIA established its own flag, anthem, courts, newspapers, military-style legions, schools, medical clinics, and even a provisional government of Africa. Headquartered in Harlem, but spiritually rooted in Ethiopia and across the diaspora. It was structured with a president general, cabinet officers, ambassadors, chancellors of the exchequer, commissioners of education, industry, commerce, agriculture, and defense. And it wasn't symbolic. These titles were backed by real work. Thousands of divisions across continents managed real institutions, organized real communities, and moved real capital. The UNIA didn't imagine freedom. It practiced it. For the masses, not the elite. At a time when other black organizations, like the NAACP, were run by educated elites and funded by white philanthropists, the UNIA was built by the people for the people. It was funded by barbers, nurses, dock workers, farmers, and laborers who were sick of watching their children be denied schooling, their history erased, and their communities crushed under the weight of European and American racism. And it was working-class black people, not academics or churchmen, who showed up in the thousands to rallies, marched in military parades, and wore the red, black, and green with pride. To them, the UNIA didn't just offer hope. It offered infrastructure. The Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World, 1920. At the first international convention of the UNIA in Harlem in 1920, where over 25,000 black people from across the world filled Madison Square Garden, the UNIA presented a document that would become its Constitution of Liberation. It was called the Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World. It included 54 demands and affirmations, including the right of black people to self-govern, the rejection of the term Negro as a racial slur, the demand for land, industry, and education free from white control, the declaration that Africa belonged to Africans, at home and abroad. It was bold. It was dangerous. And it was delivered before an empire that was watching very closely. The flag that carried a people. At that same convention, the UNIA unveiled a symbol that still flies today. A flag made up of three powerful colors. Red for the blood of Africans shed in resistance. Black for the skin and identity of the people. Green for the land of Africa and the hope of its restoration. This flag wasn't decorative. It was a declaration of war against white supremacy, erasure, and colonial theft. For a people scattered by ships, broken by chains, and denied even the dignity of their history, the red, black, and green was not just a symbol. It was a home in cloth. Why it was feared. The UNIA wasn't dangerous because it promoted violence. It didn't. It was dangerous because it gave black people dignity, direction, and discipline. Governments feared it. White supremacists loathed it. And even some black intellectuals felt threatened by its grassroots, unapologetic blackness. They knew the truth. The UNIA wasn't begging for access. It was organizing for departure, from mental slavery, from colonial structures, and eventually, from Western nations altogether. It was the seed of what we now call Pan-Africanism. But it was more than an idea. It was a machine. Closing reflection. The UNIA was not born out of a single man's ambition. It was born out of a global black scream that said, "We are tired of waiting. We are tired of begging. We will build our own." In a world that had stolen their languages, their names, their gods, their nations, the UNIA offered something profound. A reconstructed black identity, with a flag, an army, a press, a currency, a homeland, and a destiny. And that's where our journey begins. A global movement, UNIA's explosive growth. What began in a room became a roar across oceans. By the time most empires began to recognize the UNIA as a legitimate threat, it was already too late. They had laughed at it, dismissed it, scoffed at its red, black, and green banners, its uniforms, its African legions, its paper currencies and parades. To colonial governors, it was a loud but harmless spectacle. But within 5 years of its founding, the UNIA had become the largest black-led movement in modern recorded history, claiming more than 6 million members and over 1,100 branches across 43 countries. This was not a rumor. This was a revolution in slow motion, building not on bullets, but belief. The geography of a movement. To understand the UNIA's power, you must understand its reach. This wasn't just a Harlem story. It wasn't just a Jamaican or American phenomenon. It was everywhere the African diaspora had been scattered, in the ashes of plantations, in ports, in slums, in cities rising under European flags. By the 1920s, UNIA divisions could be found in North America, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, New Orleans, Toronto, Nova Scotia, Caribbean, Kingston, Port of Spain, Bridgetown, Nassau, Port-au-Prince, St. Thomas, Central America, Panama City, Cologne, Limon, Costa Rica, Bluefields, Nicaragua, South America, Georgetown, Guyana, Paramaribo, Suriname, Africa, Lagos, Accra, Freetown, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Monrovia, Europe, London, Liverpool, Paris, Oceania, even tiny delegations in Australia and New Zealand. Everywhere black people were, from enslaved descendants in Brazil to port workers in Sierra Leone. The UNIA gave them structure, identity, and a mission. How did it grow so fast? It wasn't magic. It was method. Print media mastery. The UNIA published The Negro World, a multilingual newspaper that was banned in over a dozen colonial territories, which only made it more desired. Smuggled in sugar sacks, stashed in Bibles, or sewn into clothing, it reached 500,000 readers weekly in English, Spanish, and French. Local chapters with central vision. Each UNIA branch operated semi-autonomously, running its own meetings, businesses, parades, and even courts, but stayed loyal to a central charter and ideology. Pageantry and pride. Garvey understood spectacle. The African legions marched in uniform. Women wore sashes of rank. Parades were held with trumpets, banners, and drums, rivaling military ceremonies of colonial rulers. Accessibility for the poor. Membership dues were modest. Anyone could join. No degree required. No wealthy sponsor needed. All you needed was belief in black sovereignty. The power of a nation in exile. Unlike other political organizations, the UNIA offered a complete vision, a government in waiting. People weren't just joining a cause, they were becoming citizens of a future black empire. The role of ports, churches, and barbershops. UNIA's expansion strategy was smart. They didn't need skyscrapers or TV ads. They needed people, and they met them where they lived. Ports and shipping docks were crucial. Black sailors carried copies of the Negro World to every country they docked in. Churches served as meeting halls where liberation theology merged with black nationalism. Barbershops were the street corner universities, spaces of strategy and storytelling, where membership could be recruited and propaganda spread over the sound of razors and laughter. It wasn't just a movement. It was a rumor of freedom, passed from hand to hand, whispered in code, shouted in rallies. UNIA conventions, Black globalism in action. Every year, the UNIA held massive international conventions. The most famous was in 1920, in Harlem. Over 25,000 Black delegates from across the globe attended, traveling by ship, train, and carriage, dressed in regal garb, marching under one flag, chanting one slogan: Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. At the Liberty Hall, located at 114 West 138th Street in Harlem, the movement's global command center, they passed resolutions, published manifestos, issued diplomatic appointments, and structured Black nationhood in exile. From the balconies, Caribbean women read revolutionary poems. On the floor, African veterans debated land policy and trade. In the aisles, vendors sold pamphlets, buttons, and fabrics dyed in red, black, and green. It was pan-African democracy before any African nation was free. Banned by colonies, feared by governments. The British banned the Negro world from Trinidad, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, and Kenya. French colonies intercepted UNIA letters. The US began spying on every delegate traveling into Harlem for UNIA conventions. Why? Because the UNIA wasn't just calling for better treatment, it was calling for the end of white imperial rule. In one stroke, it undermined colonial loyalty, delegitimized missionary propaganda, gave Black soldiers an alternative allegiance, reawakened ancestral pride that had been strategically erased. It was a psychological jailbreak, and the wardens panicked. Membership by the millions, but not just numbers. The 6 million members were not passive. They were active organizers. They built UNIA-run schools, credit unions, farms, bakeries, and newspapers, created burial societies and healthcare systems, hosted military drills, debate nights, and African culture festivals. In many ways, the UNIA was what post-colonial African states would one day try to be. But in the 1920s, it was ahead of its time, and because of that, it was hunted relentlessly. Closing reflection, when the dispersed became a nation. Imagine this. A descendant of enslaved Africans in Mississippi is reading the same newspaper as a post-slavery child in Nairobi, while a dock worker in Belize wears the same sash as a teacher in Trinidad. They do not know each other. They do not speak the same dialect. But they are citizens of the same imagined Black nation, loyal to a flag born of survival, a future born of memory. That's what the UNIA achieved. It took a people scattered by conquest and gave them one direction, forward. Structure of a sovereign dream, government in exile. The UNIA did not behave like a social club. It did not act like a protest group or a charity organization. From its earliest formation, it operated like a government. A sovereign structure, built in exile, without borders or state recognition, yet fully functional in vision and design. It called itself the Provisional Government of Africa. This was not metaphor. This was method. The UNIA imagined the future not as something to be begged for, but something to be built, brick by brick, system by system. If Africa was to be free one day, then its government had to exist in blueprint form before it existed on the soil. And the UNIA would be that blueprint. Inside Liberty Hall in Harlem and hundreds of branch halls across the world, the movement created a model of Black self-rule that mirrored the formalities of any nation-state. There was a president general, elected by the delegates of all divisions. This figure served as both symbolic head of state and strategic commander of the movement's global direction. There was a vice president, a secretary general, a chancellor of the exchequer, and a minister of defense. These were not just titles. These were assigned to real individuals who oversaw departments, budgets, policies, and international outreach. Every local UNIA chapter had its own leadership board. They operated schools, ran community banks, handled logistics, and trained legions. They issued membership cards and identification booklets, created postal services and burial insurance, and held their own court trials for internal disputes. It was not chaos. It was structured, disciplined, and uniform. All of it followed a constitution. That constitution was called the Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World. Passed in 1920 at the first international convention in Harlem, it was a revolutionary document, not because it called for war, but because it named a people. Not as a scattered group of victims, but as one global race of sovereign citizens with unalienable rights. The document outlined specific declarations that the Negro people were one people across all lands, that they had the right to self-rule, that the term Negro was to be respected, not used as slander, that Africa belonged to Africans, both at home and abroad, that the black man and woman were equal to all races and should control their own education, economy, and destiny. Within the structure of the UNIA, there were even noble titles bestowed upon key members. Dukes, duchesses, knights, and lady commanders of the African Redemption were appointed, not in mimicry of European monarchy, but as a way of restoring dignity to a people whose royalty had been stripped, stolen, or forgotten. One of the most effective branches of the structure was the African Legion, the UNIA's paramilitary wing. These were black men trained to march, defend, and represent the military potential of a free African government. They wore uniforms, practiced drills, and paraded in formation down the streets of Harlem and Kingston and Monrovia, not to intimidate, but to send a clear message to the world. The black man would never again be seen as defenseless. The African Legion was accompanied by the Black Cross nurses, the women's medical and humanitarian wing of the UNIA. They wore crisp white uniforms with armbands and provided free medical assistance in communities where public health was inaccessible or racist. They were the healers, the protectors, the first responders. They symbolized a new image of the African woman, not just as mother, but as organizer and soldier of freedom. In addition to its government, the UNIA had its own court system. Internal disputes among members were handled by tribunals with elected judges. These systems allowed the community to resolve conflicts without relying on racist colonial courts that rarely served black justice. The UNIA also had its own currency. The movement printed stock certificates, promissory notes, and investment receipts for the Black Star Line, its commercial shipping project. It wasn't yet a fully independent economy, but it was the beginning of one. There was even a foreign policy doctrine. The UNIA had diplomats. Ambassadors were appointed to represent the organization in Africa, the Caribbean, South America, and Europe. They negotiated land for resettlement in Liberia. They held forums with African nationalists. They formed alliances with anti-colonial leaders long before most of them would become heads of state. This wasn't imitation of white governments. It was invention of a black one. It was sovereignty rehearsed. Inside every UNIA division, children were taught African history, public speaking, civic duty, and economic literacy. Boys trained in flag-raising ceremonies. Girls trained in business and healthcare. Weekly meetings opened with a pledge to the Pan-African flag, which was treated not as a decoration, but as a national symbol. Red for the blood that unites all people of African ancestry. Black for the race that was once scattered, but never broken. Green for the motherland that awaited its sons and daughters. To the world, the UNIA was just a movement, but to its members, it was their government, their identity, their future. The structure was not an experiment. It was a rehearsal for freedom. While other organizations waited for seats at the table of white democracy, the UNIA built its own table, its own house, and declared its independence. Long before the African continent would officially begin to break its chains, the structure of the UNIA did not survive unchanged. It fractured under pressure, infiltration, and leadership conflict. But the dream it built, the sovereign dream, remains the most detailed attempt in modern history to give the African diaspora a nation of its own. Not just in spirit, but in system. And for a while, that system functioned like a state waiting for land. A people without borders, but not without order. A government in exile, that dared to believe it would one day come home. Black Cross nurses, African legions, and the UNIA press. To build a nation, you need more than a dream. You need people ready to protect it, heal it, and speak for it. The UNIA wasn't just words and flags. It was discipline. It was structure. It was system. And nowhere was that more evident than in the institutions it created. Institutions that not only served the people, but embodied the very nation the world refused to recognize. This chapter explores three pillars of that invisible nation: the Black Cross nurses, the African Legion, and the Negro World newspaper. Each one had a purpose. Each one had a uniform. Each one sent a message. We are ready. The Black Cross nurses, dignity in white. You didn't need to see the red, black, and green to know the UNIA was nearby. Sometimes all you had to see was a woman, head held high, uniform pressed, moving with grace through the slums, the hills, or the sugarcane fields. That woman was likely a Black Cross nurse. Founded in 1920, the Black Cross nurses were more than a medical corps. They were revolutionary caretakers trained in hygiene, nutrition, public health, childbirth, and emergency care. At a time when many Black people were denied access to hospitals, these women provided critical health services in neglected communities across the Caribbean, Africa, and the Americas. But beyond their service, the symbolism ran deep. Their uniforms were modeled on the Red Cross, but with an African insignia, reclaiming a space where Black women had long been excluded. When they entered a home, they brought more than bandages. They brought sovereign dignity. They were trained not just to care for wounds, but to inspire, to show Black girls what power looked like in the form of a healer, to teach entire communities that health was not a gift from government, it was a right that could be self-administered. The African Legion, marching toward sovereignty. The African Legion was the UNIA's disciplined, uniformed male division, not a militia, but a visual declaration of readiness. Founded to serve as the movement's honor guard, security, and ceremonial force, the Legion was made up of Black men trained in drills, protocols, and tactical unity. They didn't carry weapons. They didn't threaten violence. But when they marched, people paid attention. With sharp uniforms, synchronized formations, and symbolic regalia, the African Legion made it clear. The African race would never again be seen as helpless. They paraded down the streets of Harlem. They stood guard at UNIA conventions. They escorted dignitaries and served as protectors of Liberty Halls across the globe. They represented the future African army, not of conquest, but of defense, because no self-respecting nation could exist without the ability to protect its people. Their motto was simple: one God, one aim, one destiny. And when they moved, the world saw what destiny looked like, with a straight back, a sharp salute, and a banner that read, "Africa for the Africans." The Negro world, the voice of the movement. No movement survives without its voice. And the UNIA's voice was loud, clear, and global. It came from the pages of the Negro World. This revolutionary newspaper was printed in 3 languages and distributed in over 40 countries. It was banned in many of them. Why? Because it taught Black people to think freely, to know their history, to question their conditions. It published everything from liberation poetry to anti-lynching reports, editorials on African independence, women's rights columns, and cultural pride essays. When Black children read the Negro World, they saw stories of kings and queens, scientists and soldiers, all from their own lineage. When enslaved descendants in Panama or Nigeria held it in their hands, they felt the hum of something bigger, the connection to a global movement that saw them not as labor, but as legacy. And when authorities tried to ban it, smuggle it out, or burn it, the people read it in secret, memorized it, passed it on. Because when truth is illegal, memory becomes a weapon. Institutions as resistance. The UNIA's genius wasn't just in its speeches, it was in its systems. With the Black Cross nurses, it created care. With the African Legion, it modeled defense. With the Negro World, it controlled the narrative. Together, these institutions told the world, "We are not a movement. We are a nation in rehearsal." These weren't symbolic gestures. These were foundations of freedom. In a time when most Black people were denied education, citizenship, healthcare, and dignity, the UNIA provided all 4, not through charity, but through infrastructure. Final reflection: the flags may have faded, the marches may have stopped, the Liberty Halls may have gone quiet, but the legacy of these institutions remains carved into the soul of Black resistance. The Black Cross nurses walked so that modern public health movements could run. The African Legion marched so that sovereignty would never again look impossible. And the Negro World printed words so powerful, they still echo in the global Pan-African movement today. Because when you build a nation, you don't just raise a flag. You raise people. You raise systems. And then you raise the truth until the world can't look away. The Negro World, controlling the narrative. When truth is illegal, printing it becomes a revolutionary act. It started with ink and ended with fire. In the hands of the UNIA, a newspaper became more than just paper. It became a weapon, a bridge, a mirror, a lifeline. It was called the Negro World, and through it, the Black diaspora learned to see itself, not through the eyes of empire, but through its own. Before radio, before television, before the internet, there was the press. In the 1920s, the newspaper was the most powerful tool of information. and the most dangerous. Whoever controlled the press controlled the perception of reality. The UNI understood that, and so it created its own reality. One printed in three languages, shipped across oceans, and passed from hand to hand in whispers. The Negro World was first published in 1918. Edited by leaders like Amy Jacques Garvey, it quickly became the ideological heartbeat of the movement. Not only did it report UNI activities, it taught black history, amplified African culture, advocated for women's rights, and denounced colonial propaganda. It was printed weekly in English, Spanish, and French, so that whether you lived in Harlem, Haiti, Honduras, or Nigeria, you could hold the same truth in your hands. The newspaper featured everything from international news, political editorials, poems, cultural essays, letters from readers, and profiles of black scientists, philosophers, and rebels. In its pages, readers saw the continent of Africa not as a pitiful colony, but as a majestic homeland. They saw blackness not as a burden, but as a badge of dignity. But the paper's greatest strength? It unified a people scattered by empire. It gave them a shared voice. And for that, it became a target. Banned truths. By the early 1920s, the Negro World was officially banned in over a dozen British and French colonies, including Trinidad, Jamaica, Kenya, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. The colonial authorities didn't fear guns. They feared literacy. They feared that one paragraph, one headline, one poem could be enough to light a fire in the minds of the colonized. So they called the newspaper dangerous, seditious. They arrested those caught with it. They raided homes, ports, and barbershops to stop it from entering. But the black world is no stranger to smuggling survival. Dock workers hid issues inside flour sacks and molasses barrels. Sailors sewed them into coats. Preachers tucked copies behind altar cloths. In sugarcane fields, enslaved descendants read the editorials aloud like scripture. In the hills of Jamaica and the coast of Ghana, young men passed it like contraband wisdom. The more the world tried to silence it, the louder it grew. A voice of many tongues. What made the Negro World so effective was its multilingual strategy. Spanish editions circulated heavily in Cuba, Panama, and Central America. French editions reached Haiti, Senegal, and Martinique. And English editions spread from Harlem to Nova Scotia, from Belize to Sierra Leone. This wasn't coincidence. It was strategy. The UNIA knew its movement was global, and so its voice had to be global too. It wasn't just speaking to one nation. It was speaking to a nation without borders. A people separated by ocean, but united by memory. And that voice didn't just tell stories. It rewrote them. The power of the pen. Inside each issue, you could find political commentary on African independence, reports from local UNIA divisions around the world, essays on self-reliance and economic control, women's columns advocating for leadership and education, poetry from diasporic writers and schoolchildren, messages from the Provisional Government of Africa, anti-lynching coverage ignored by white newspapers, cartoons mocking colonial rulers and uplifting black power. The Negro World turned ordinary people into journalists, historians, thinkers, and organizers. It made readers more than consumers. It made them citizens of a coming black future. And it did all this without advertising from white businesses, without endorsement from governments, and without approval from polite society. It was funded by black hands, powered by black minds, and written for black eyes. The woman behind the pages. One of the most significant editors of the Negro World was Amy Jacques Garvey, a fierce intellectual and strategist. She was not merely a publisher's wife. She was a powerhouse. Amy Jacques introduced a women's section called Our Women and What They Think, a revolutionary addition in a time when most liberation movements still sidelined female voices. She championed issues of black motherhood, womanhood, and community leadership. Through her editorial leadership, the newspaper became a vehicle not just for political awakening, but for gender balance within the black liberation discourse. The paper that couldn't be erased. The Negro World continued publishing into the 1930s, long after other organizations folded under government pressure. Its physical copies were sometimes burned, its distributors arrested, its editors harassed, but its impact could never be imprisoned. It changed how people saw themselves. It taught black children that their history didn't begin with chains. It taught their parents that they didn't need permission to imagine greatness. And it taught the world, with every banned issue, every smuggled edition, every whisper behind plantation doors, that the black voice would never again be silent. Final reflection. They say the victors write history. But what happens when the oppressed print it themselves? The Negro world was the printing press of a revolution. It didn't ask for permission. It didn't wait for validation. It simply told the truth, over and over, until that truth became too big to ignore. The UNIA didn't just fight for land. It fought for the narrative. Because whoever tells the story controls the future. The Black Star Line, repatriation or ruin. They built a fleet before they had a nation and dared to sail toward freedom. It was a dream bigger than land, bigger than politics, bigger even than revolution. It was the dream of return, the return to Africa, the return to ownership, the return to self-determination, not in theory, but in motion. In 1919, the UNIA launched the Black Star Line, a bold, unprecedented shipping company created by and for Black people, not just as a business, but as a symbol, a vessel of liberation, a fleet for the displaced. For centuries, ships had been used to steal Africans from their homeland. The Black Star Line would do the opposite. It would carry their descendants home, physically, economically, and psychologically. This was not charity. This was ownership, a vision at sea. At the height of the UNIA's influence, Marcus Garvey and his team unveiled the plan, a fleet of Black-owned steamships that would connect the African diaspora to the continent itself. They envisioned cargo runs between the Caribbean, the United States, Central America, and West Africa. Not just passengers, but trade. Not just people, but power. To fund it, they sold shares to everyday Black people, domestic workers, sharecroppers, porters, factory workers, who believed not just in the company, but in the cause. Over $800,000 was raised through community rallies, street corner speeches, and Liberty Hall investments. In a time when Black people were denied bank loans, denied maritime licenses, denied respect, they simply created their own blueprint. The Black Star Line's mission was threefold: economic independence for the diaspora, repatriation pathways to Africa, a physical expression of Black sovereignty on global waters, the ships and their struggles. The first ship acquired was the SS Yarmouth, renamed SS Frederick Douglass. It was purchased at an inflated price and was in poor mechanical condition. Still, the symbolism outweighed the rust. The ship was paraded in Harlem as a symbol of hope. Thousands turned out to see it. Children waved flags. Elders wept. For the first time in modern history, a ship was being launched for them. More ships followed, or were attempted to. But the Black Star Line quickly encountered heavy turbulence. Corruption from within, mechanical failures, inexperienced leadership, and worst of all, infiltration. Sabotage from within. The Black Star Line was being watched closely by the United States government. Federal agents infiltrated UNIA meetings, forged documents, and targeted the movement's business operations with legal traps. The Bureau of Investigation, the precursor to the FBI, had made Marcus Garvey and his vision a top priority threat. They weren't worried about violence. They were worried about Black ambition. In 1922, Garvey was indicted for mail fraud, accused of misleading investors about the company's assets. The case was built on shaky grounds, propped up by internal spies, and largely driven by racial and political fears. Garvey was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison. With their leader on trial and their ships deteriorating, the Black Star Line began to sink, not just financially, but symbolically. Failure or foundation. By the mid-1920s, the Black Star Line ceased operations. Ships were sold. Stockholders suffered losses. Critics declared the dream dead. But what they misunderstood was this. The Black Star Line wasn't about ships. It was about scale. It was the first time Black people, across continents, had united their coins and convictions to fund a global enterprise. It was the first time the idea of African economic sovereignty had been made physical. And though the ships decayed, the idea remained seaworthy. Future movements would be inspired by the Black Star Line. Ghana's national shipping line, under Kwame Nkrumah, was named in its honor. Modern Pan-Africanists cite it as proof of Black financial mobilization. And today, the very notion of reparations and transnational solidarity echoes its original mission. The Black Star Line did not sail forever, but it did something more important. It proved that Black people could fund, build, and launch freedom without permission. Final reflection. They tried to break the ship. They tried to jail the captain. They tried to drown the dream. But the tide had already turned. The Black Star Line was more than a fleet. It was a faith that our journey back to dignity might be long, might be broken, might be betrayed, but it would never stop. Because once a people have imagined themselves free, no ocean is wide enough to hold them back. The Empire Strikes Back, FBI, sabotage, and the criminalization of a movement. When Black Power begins to organize, Empire calls it a crime. The movement was growing. Too fast. Too global. Too powerful. By the early 1920s, the UNIA was no longer a small Pan-African experiment. It was a global phenomenon. It had its own flag, its own constitution, its own newspaper, nurses, legions, courts, and ships. It had built a black government in exile, and that government had millions of citizens. To the empires of the world, this was war. Not the kind fought with guns, the kind fought with ideas, with vision, with identity. And that made the UNIA more dangerous than any army. J. Edgar Hoover and the Bureau of Obsession. In Washington, D.C., a young Justice Department lawyer named J. Edgar Hoover took notice. He was ambitious, calculating, and obsessed with internal threats. But none disturbed him more than Marcus Garvey. In Garvey, he saw a man not just rallying black people, but organizing them. Not just speaking out, but building institutions. Creating schools, creating jobs, naming enemies. All with charisma that rivaled world leaders. Hoover feared what Garvey represented. A black man commanding global loyalty, promoting race pride, and speaking openly of independence from colonial powers. So Hoover wrote, "He is a notorious Negro agitator. His activities must be watched carefully." That watching turned into full-scale surveillance. Under Hoover's guidance, the Bureau of Investigation, the predecessor of the FBI, opened a file on Garvey. Dozens of black informants were recruited. UNIA meetings were bugged. Personal letters were intercepted. Leaders were tailed. It was one of the first major political surveillance operations in American history, and its target was not a criminal. Its target was a vision, infiltration, fabrication, and the mail fraud trap. Unable to find evidence of violence or incitement, the Bureau shifted strategy. If they couldn't stop the UNIA, they'd cripple it from within. They sent informants like James Wormley Jones, the first black FBI agent, to infiltrate the highest levels of the organization. Others posed as supporters, then reported back every misstep and internal disagreement. Eventually, the government found its opening, not in political rebellion, but in paperwork. They accused Garvey of mail fraud, charging him with misleading investors about the Black Star Line's assets. The case hinged on a brochure that advertised a ship the line hadn't yet fully secured. The details were flimsy. The damage was minimal, but it was enough. In 1923, after a public trial marred by racial bias and fabricated evidence, Garvey was convicted. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. The movement's founder, the man who had once addressed 25,000 people in Madison Square Garden, was now behind bars. And the empire had struck its first major blow. Divide, dismantle, deport. Garvey's imprisonment had a chilling effect. The UNIA fractured under internal disputes, leadership challenges, and relentless pressure from authorities. Chapters in the Caribbean and Africa were raided. Publications were halted. The Negro world was increasingly censored. UNIA members faced job loss, public harassment, and community ostracism. In 1927, after serving 2 years, Garvey was released, but not to freedom. He was deported to Jamaica. A citizen of the British Empire, he was barred from re-entering the United States. It was exile in every sense, geographic, political, and symbolic. The movement that had once stretched across oceans was now leaderless in its most active territories. And yet it did not die. The blueprint that couldn't be burned. Though the UNIA lost momentum in the United States, it continued in Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. In Liberia, its ideas influenced land reclamation efforts. In Ghana, its flag and philosophy became the blueprint for independence. In Jamaica, its community halls still stood as testaments to self-reliance. The empire had won the battle, but the idea had survived the war. What they didn't understand was this. You can imprison a man. You can shut down an office. You can burn a newspaper. But you can't kill a blueprint that lives in the minds of millions. The real threat wasn't Garvey. It was the fact that millions believed him. They believed they were a people. They believed they had a right to rule themselves. They believed they didn't need to beg for freedom. They could build it. Final reflection. This was not just sabotage. It was a warning that anytime black people begin to organize globally, anytime we create structure, identity, defense, and narrative, The systems of empire will rise, not in fear of violence, but in fear of vision. The story of the Unia's criminalization is not unique. It is a blueprint repeated across time. In every Black movement that dares to build something permanent, empire responds the same way. With silence, then scrutiny, then sabotage. But what the empire never learns is that vision, once ignited, cannot be unseen. It spreads. It survives. It waits. Until one day, it rises again. Women of the UNIA, power behind the throne. History often remembers movements by their male leaders. But in the case of the UNIA, the women didn't just support the throne. They built it, protected it, and often ruled from behind its curtain. They marched. They printed. They organized, educated, and resisted. While the spotlight often followed Marcus Garvey, the soul of the UNIA pulsed through the women who held it together. In Chapter 8, we shift the lens to the fierce, disciplined, and visionary women who helped construct one of the largest Black liberation movements in history. From editors and nurses to educators and orators, these women weren't assistants, they were architects. Amy Jacques Garvey, the strategist in the shadows. At the center of this chapter stands Amy Jacques Garvey, not simply the wife of Marcus Garvey, but a towering intellect and political force in her own right. When Marcus was imprisoned, it was Amy who kept the UNIA's flame alive. She edited the Negro World newspaper, publishing cutting-edge political essays and pioneering a women's column titled, Are Women and What They Think. She raised funds for the legal defense. She held mass meetings. She toured the country speaking on behalf of the movement, not as a placeholder, but as a leader. She challenged both colonialism and patriarchy. She understood that race and gender could not be separated in the struggle for sovereignty. Amy Jacques Garvey was the quiet storm, the pen sharper than any sword. And through her, the UNIA's core message was refined, expanded, and made sustainable. Black Cross nurses, matriarchs in uniform. While soldiers marched outside, the Black Cross nurses held the communities together from within. In every country where the UNIA planted roots, you could find these women, dressed in white, organized in battalions, practicing first aid, maternal health, sanitation, and social service. Their uniforms represented more than care, they represented respect. Black women, so often pushed to the margins of both health systems and political arenas, were now central actors in a sovereign structure. They trained in nursing and were taught to carry themselves with pride, purpose, and presence. To see a Black Cross nurse walk through a village was to witness the birth of Black womanhood as authority. Organizers, educators, orators, leaders. The movement was teeming with women who operated as division presidents, public speakers, youth mentors, court judges, business managers, parade coordinators, fundraisers, cultural historians. In cities like Philadelphia, Port-au-Prince, Accra, and Panama City, women led local chapters. They ran Liberty Halls, taught in schools, organized parades, and hosted community workshops. Their names, though often missing from headlines, were the invisible ink holding the UNIA's global document together. Feminism within Pan-Africanism. What made the women of the UNIA so revolutionary was that they didn't wait for permission. They wrote themselves into the revolution. They recognized that while race unity was vital, gender justice could not be delayed. They rejected Victorian models of womanhood that cast them as passive. They rejected European feminism that ignored colonial oppression. And they rejected any Black nationalism that placed them at the foot instead of at the forefront. In their speeches, writings, and organizing, they embodied a Black womanist vision, one that centered liberation through family, culture, economics, and political power. The double burden. The women of the UNIA carried two battles, one against the world, colonialism, racism, poverty, and another within their own communities, patriarchy, dismissal, underrecognition. They stood by the dream, even when the movement's spotlight didn't stand on them. They taught the children, healed the sick, balanced the accounts, wrote the essays. They kept the nation alive while the nation still debated their role in it. But despite this, they persisted. And in doing so, they laid a foundation for future generations of Black women revolutionaries to rise without apology. Final reflection. They weren't backup singers. They were the melody. They weren't shadows behind a man. They were flames that lit the hall. To understand the UNIA without its women is to misunderstand it completely. Because what they built wasn't just a support system. It was a governmental, intellectual, and emotional engine. And today, when we speak of Pan-Africanism, sovereignty, and resistance, their names must rise with it. Not as footnotes, but as front lines. UNIA's global echo, legacy across continents. You can deport a man, you can ban a newspaper, but you can't stop an idea whose roots are buried across the world. The headlines faded, the ships were gone, the halls quieted. To the outside world, the UNI looked like it had vanished, swallowed by trials, sabotage, and time. But they misunderstood what the UNI really was. It was never just a man, never just a building, never just a headline. It was a seed, planted on five continents. And even as empires tried to bury it, it grew. This chapter traces the global echo of the UNIA, the aftershock that outlived Garvey's imprisonment, his deportation, and his death. Because what the world thought was over was only replanting itself. Africa, dream to blueprint. In Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah openly cited Garvey and the UNIA as inspirations for the Pan-African independence movement. The red, black, and green became Ghana's flag colors. The Black Star became the name of the national shipping line, the Black Star Line reborn under African control. Liberia, which Garvey had long dreamed of as a return destination, later hosted UNIA chapters that advocated for land reform, anti-colonial education, and black nationalism. Even in Nigeria, early activists in the anti-colonial struggle used the Negro world and UNIA philosophies to push for independence from British rule. What began as a movement of letters and parades became a blueprint for governance. Caribbean, the heartbeat of the diaspora. In the Caribbean, the UNIA never died. In Jamaica, Liberty Halls became cultural institutions. In Trinidad, Black Cross nurses continued community work. And across Barbados, Belize, St. Lucia, and more, UNIA divisions outlived Garvey himself. These weren't relics. They were resistance centers, passing on identity and pride generation to generation. When the civil rights movements of the 1960s rose up, the Caribbean already had a foundation, laid by the women and men of the UNIA decades earlier. The Caribbean had not forgotten, because it had led. Latin America and Central America, hidden hubs of rebellion. Few know the UNIA's reach stretched deep into Honduras, Costa Rica, Panama, and Colombia, where Afro-descendant populations, largely forgotten by their governments, turned to the UNIA for structure and identity. In Panama, dockworkers and canal laborers read the Negro World in secret, organized labor strikes with UNIA support, and flew red, black, and green flags in defiance of American imperialism. The movement gave dignity to people who were told they didn't belong to any nation. The UNIA told them, "You belong to all of us." North America, more than Harlem. While Harlem was the UNIA's epicenter, its influence was national. In Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles, and across Canada, UNIA chapters established schools, cooperatives, and youth brigades. Even after the federal crackdown, these spaces became safe havens for Black pride and self-governance. The Nation of Islam, the Black Panthers, and even civil rights organizations borrowed strategies, symbolism, and structure from the UNIA. They watched the empire burn it down, and still they said, "We saw what it could be. Now let's build again." Europe and beyond, the invisible echo. Even in London, Paris, and Amsterdam, the UNIA planted seeds. African students studying abroad read Garvey's works and returned home as revolutionaries. Caribbean migrants in Europe brought the flame with them, hosting lectures, starting community halls, and translating UNIA texts into local languages. The movement transcended borders. It was a passport to identity, what they couldn't kill. The most powerful part of the UNIA was that it made you believe you were more than a survivor. It made you believe you were a citizen of a global Black nation, an heir of African greatness, a builder of tomorrow, not just a victim of yesterday. That belief is unextinguishable. It shows up in flags, in speeches, in school murals, in street names, in minds that say, even now, Africa for the Africans at home and abroad. Final reflection. Garvey was deported. The ships rusted. The press was banned. But the echo outlasted it all. Because the UNIA didn't just organize people. It recoded them. And today, every movement for Black liberation, from Soweto to Ferguson, from Kingston to Kinshasa, walks in its wake. The world thought it was just a movement. It didn't realize it was a seed. And the harvest is still coming. The UNIA lives on, blueprint for future generations. They thought they buried a man. What they planted was a nation. Time has passed. Names have faded. But the mission, it still breathes. The UNIA may no longer dominate headlines or host parades down the avenues of Harlem, but its blueprint, it's been copied, quoted, rebuilt, and reborn again and again. In this final chapter, we close the book not with an ending, but with a transition. From history to inheritance. From movement to method. From slogan to strategy. One God, one aim, one destiny. Those weren't just words on a banner. They were the UNIA's operating code. It created a Pan-African structure that others would follow. A flag that now flies from government buildings. A press that shaped the voice of a people. A shipping line that taught us economic courage. A military-style legion that marched with dignity. A nursing corps that modeled self-reliant healthcare. A government in exile that imagined sovereignty before it existed. From these pillars, the modern Black world has pulled inspiration and instruction. Legacy and movements. When you see the Black power fist, the UNIA was there first. When you hear chants of Africa for the Africans, the echo belongs to Garvey's vision. When you study the structure of the Nation of Islam, the Black Panthers, or Rastafari, you're seeing the fingerprints of the UNIA. Even institutions that don't wear the name wear the blueprint, because the UNIA didn't just demand justice. It built the architecture for it, the flag that never lowered. Today, the red, black, and green flag remains a global symbol. Red for the blood that unites the diaspora and was shed in the fight for liberation. Black for the people. Green for the land of Africa, promised and ancestral. It is flown in protests, painted in murals, printed on t-shirts, and woven into identity. It's a flag that never asked permission to exist. It was declared. And that spirit of self-definition is what still fuels youth movements today. The rise of a new generation. We are no longer in Liberty Halls. We are on YouTube, on WhatsApp, on TikTok, on community radio stations, and at grassroots think tanks. In barbershops and classrooms and protest marches. And everywhere the question echoes. Who are we without colonizers? What can we build without begging? What does a Black future look like, on our terms? These are UNIA questions, still being asked, still being answered. And the tools they left us, unity, structure, pride, discipline, remain our inheritance. More than a man. In the end, the UNIA proved that Black sovereignty didn't need charity. It needed coordination. It needed belief. It needed courage. And perhaps most dangerously of all, it needed us to see ourselves as a nation before the world ever did. Garvey was the messenger. But the movement was us. Final reflection. The UNIA lives on. In every act of Black unity. In every flag raised. In every effort to control the narrative, own the economy, protect the people, and rewrite the future. It doesn't need monuments. It needs momentum. So if you're wondering where the UNIA is now, look in the mirror. Look at your community. Look at your history. Because once a people learn how to organize freedom, they never forget how.